their suffering into the indispensable gadgets and cars that we rely on every day. And that's an injustice. That's an utterly caustic, miserable formula that needs to be set right, because we can't conduct our rechargeable economy in our daily lives by inflicting such violence and suffering on some of the poorest children in the world.
Siddharth Kara, we want to thank you so much for being with us, author of the new book, Cobalt Red, How the Blood of the Congo Powers Our Lives. His previous book, Sex Trafficking Inside the Business of Modern Slavery, won the 2010 Frederick Douglass Book Prize, awarded for the best book written in English on slavery or abolition. That does it for our show, Democracy Now! Produced with Mike Burke, Renee Feldstein, Augusta Messiah Rhodes, Maria Tarasena, Tammy Warnoff, Tarina Nadura, Sam Alkoff. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio and the Jazz Society of Oregon are proud to present the 43rd Annual Cathedral Park Jazz Festival broadcast July 14, 15, and 16 at Cathedral Park in North Portland. KBOO will begin the live broadcast Friday at 4:30 p.m., and Saturday and Sunday's broadcast will get underway at 1 p.m. That's the 43rd Annual Cathedral Park Jazz Festival broadcasting Friday, July 14, Saturday, July 15, and Sunday, July 16, here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
Thank you. This radio show contains graphic descriptions of violence, occasional use of the N-word, and other content that some people may find disturbing or offensive.
This radio show was produced at KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Oregon.
I had joined the Coalition for Human Dignity. It was something that I was interested in as a Jew and wanted to help with. So 2 weeks after I had joined, nothing was purposeful on this at all. But what happened was my daughter and two of her friends were coming home along Southeast 39. They were between Hawthorne and Alder. And a truckload of skinheads went by, about seven of them, some in the back and some in the front, and they were doing Sieg Heils, shouting Nazi slogans.
Carloads of Nazi boneheads would drive around and look for people to attack. They were driving along Hawthorne Boulevard. A young woman and two men were walking along Hawthorne. One of the Nazi boneheads gave a Nazi salute. One of the teenagers flipped them off with both fingers, you know. They grabbed their baseball bats and chased them for blocks.
So they took off running, and the skinheads followed them and started chasing them with baseball bats, 2x4s. Luckily, my daughter knocked on someone's door. She screamed, "Help us, please." Thank God, the woman, Mary Steiger, an 80-year-old woman, opened the door and let my kids in.
So here are these terrified kids who ran to this house that an older woman said, "Yeah, you can come in here." The truckload of Nazis attacked that household right away, threatened to kill her for not giving up the kids, and bashed in her car.
Later on that night, a group of skinheads went back to Mary Steiger's home and broke all of her lower level windows, yelled death threats at her. This is an 80-some-year-old woman.
She had done the right thing. She had defended and guarded these young kids. A household full of elderly people, fearful for their lives, appealed to the police. Police basically said, we can't do anything. So somehow word got back to us, and we said, "Do you want us to sit on your front porch?" And she said, "I want you in my front parlor. Wherever you best feel that you can guard my house." I haven't slept since then, because they'll drive by and they'll yell stuff, and I'm completely scared out of my wits. So we did. Some of us said, "Well, we're going to bring whatever is necessary to defend that household." And other people who were pacifists said, "Well, I'll just use my body." And we said, "That's okay." We did not try and tell people, "You must be armed or you must not be armed."
This exchange between Coalition for Human Dignity activists Abby Layton and M. Trelor describes one incident when local boneheads terrorized teenagers and elderly citizens after a minor affront in response to open hate signaling, not an uncommon incident in those times.
Mary Steiger's request that activists sit round the clock in her parlor marked the first time Coalition for Human Dignity activists participated in a support strategy that came to be known as a house defense, or, when they took place at night, a vigil. After that, members of CHD and other community organizations routinely guarded the homes of people who had been threatened or attacked by neo-Nazis.
The willingness of coalition members to show up in response to direct requests for support, to move beyond research and tracking, solidified their commitment to direct action on behalf of the community. These vigils also strengthened bonds between the CHD and other anti-fascist organizations like the Skinheads Against Racial Prejudice and Anti-Racist Action. I'm Selena Flores.
And I'm Mike Crenshaw. We're your hosts for It Did Happen Here. In this episode, we focus on defense strategies. The house defenses were not publicized or defined aspects of CHD's parameters. Coalition for Human Dignity Intelligence Sergeant Jonathan Mazzocchi describes how these house defense projects were organized.
You know, we had community defense projects where we would protect groups, families who were under attack by racist skinheads. And there were a number of those incidents. So part of that community defense project involved having a hotline where people could call in racist activity. And at one point up on Southeast Belmont, There was a family of Vietnamese who were being attacked by racists. We mobilized vigils there to protect them. So here you had anti-racist action with skinheads against racial prejudice, folks with, you know, a pretty powerful community leader in Donna Redwing. Donna was head of the Lesbian Community Project, who was at many of these early community-based coalition meetings. Some of the anti-racists had weapons, including firearms. So it was this sort of mixing in this coalition of people coming together to a fight against these folks that I think was very unique. Outside of that, perhaps those communities didn't have a lot of interaction, but there they could. So that stuff worked early on because the threat was very local and the threat was a vigilante group, kind of like protecting folks from the Klan. The Coalition for Human Dignity played an important role in that kind of community-based self-defense.
We had put out a public banner as, we're here, we're going to drive these folks out. People started calling us up. We had a physical location that people were living at, so there was a place mail could be received, and we had a phone that we would answer and call people back. I can't stress how important that is, call people back if you're politically organizing. We never took a penny or we never tried to publicize that widely. We felt it had to be done, and the police would not do it. They just would not guard these houses that were under attack, that were under obvious attack. So we did that. We did several others, including when there was an altercation at a convenience store, when the future members of Volksfront jumped and beat almost to death a black man in the Northeast, whose family then appealed to us for defense of their house. Again, we said, well, what do you want us to do? And she said, I want you sleeping in my front room because I'm scared. He was still in the intensive care unit at Emmanuel Hospital during the entire period that we were doing house sitting. He was there for a couple weeks. And people ask her, well, what should we bring? She said, well, you're going to bring weapons, aren't you? Let's get real. You're going to bring something in case they try and get in. I want you to kill them. She didn't say that. It was clear that that was her attitude. They're going to be here to kill us. I want you to stop them. So Randall Krager went to prison for this. And then while he was in prison, along with some of his comrades, helped form Volksfront.
Volksfront was a white supremacist organization founded in Portland out of the scraps of other Portland racist skinhead groups, including Eastside White Pride. Volksfront disbanded only in 2012 after 18 years of their existence. Their members carried out hate crimes across the region and maintained ties to national and international white neo-Nazi groups. And what happened to the skinheads who chased Abby's daughter and attacked Mary Steger's house and car?
A man named Scott Garrow was the head of this group. We had him arrested with evidence, and we took him to court. We came to court, many of us, with rainbow ribbons and with good witnesses, and he was put in prison for 2.5 years.
Other notable Portland racists sent to prison were the three boneheads who killed Mulugeta Sarah. One died in prison, one disavowed racist politics and disappeared from the public eye, and one is a zealous Trump supporter. Did these incarcerations lead to safety for the community? Were Portland activists just removing boneheads from the city so they could develop racist organizations in the suburbs or across the river in Vancouver, Washington? Or, as M. Treloar noted, in prison?
While imprisoning boneheads may result in a temporary grace period, in the Brotherhood of Prison, racist skinheads have access to recruitment of new members comfortable with criminality and violence. It is well documented that neo-Nazi prisoners have successfully organized national and international racist networks. Anti-fascists in the 1990s, much like today, did not always agree on the best way forward. Much like today, there was no best way forward. For some, locking up a racist skinhead signals a victory. For others, incarceration was just one of many methods of defense and a problematic tactic at best. Jail time kept fascists off the streets and functioned therefore as community support, but most understood it as a temporary fix to systemic problems. Problems that increased when attackers and assailants found warm reception behind bars.
Time has also shown how incarceration and gentrification work conveniently together. Efforts to drive the boneheads out of Portland dovetailed neatly with pro-development strategies to remove perceived undesirable elements from the inner city. Prison was, and still is, considered an expedient substitution to the challenge of creating an alternative to the carceral state. As Jonathan Mazzocchi noted earlier, house defense worked because the threat was local, immediate, and well within the ability and skill set of the CHD. The problem was, and continues to be, long-term solutions to the violence of hatred and poverty. Whether that violence is delivered by a fascist kick or by municipal neglect and institutionalized racism.
We have heard one coalition member talk with satisfaction about sending someone off to prison, while others talk about not trusting cops. The argument often came down to a choice between directing personal violence of the body against groups of racists versus marshaling resources to direct institutional violence of the state against fascist individuals. Jonathan Mazzocchi speaks on this directly.
This is from James Baldwin. I do not claim that everyone in prison here is innocent, but I do claim that the law, as it operates, is guilty, and that the prisoners, therefore, are all unjustly imprisoned. The point of that is that we cannot fight the right by using the justice system. We cannot fight them with cops. That does not.
Welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest with Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. It's critical commentary on foreign affairs from a human interest perspective. The opinions expressed in the following segment are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest. I'm Mel Gertov, and I'll be reporting and commenting on the most important and sometimes the most neglected international news of the past week or so. Here are today's 11 subjects. Japan's new security thinking. France on fire. Swedish membership in NATO. Taiwan's talent hunt. Chip war with China continues. The U.S. fails the human rights test in Cuba. Cluster bombs for Ukraine. Hong Kong's democracy shrinks further. The Trump of the tropics is banned from running for office. Global forest loss sets new record, and climate change helps terrorists. Japan's new security thinking. It's no secret that Japan's foreign policy and national security thinking puts the China threat at the top of the enemy list. Prime Minister Kishida Fumio's increased defense budget reflects that emphasis. But the main change is Japan's closer alignment with U.S. security coalitions. No longer is Japan content only with the 1960 security treaty with the U.S. Japan is party to the Quadrilateral Security Dialogue Group, to joint military exercises with South Korea and the U.S., and to close working relations with Australia, New Zealand, and South Korea, the Asia-Pacific Four. Now, coordination with NATO is being put in place. NATO's first liaison office in Asia will soon be set up in Tokyo. Kishida became the first Japanese prime minister to attend a NATO leaders' conference, and Japan now participates in NATO air, naval, and cyber exercises. Shortly, Japan and the other Asia-Pacific Four will be designated as NATO's individually tailored partnership program, a new arrangement that seems designed to promote interoperability between militaries and information sharing on security matters. Exactly what new responsibilities this association with NATO will entail both for NATO and Japan remain to be determined. But clearly the target is China and protection of Japan's nearby waters, as well as deterrence of a Chinese attack on Taiwan. Thus does a new Cold War descend in the Pacific. France on fire. The latest nationwide protests against police violence are over. The point-blank shooting of a 17-year-old male of Moroccan and Algerian descent had led to the sacking of hundreds of police stations, widespread vandalizing of businesses and banks, and the deployment of 45,000 police. Over 3,000 people were arrested. For anyone familiar with racism and police violence in the banlieue, the economically depressed urban areas that are home to large migrant populations, the latest rioting was not unexpected. President Emmanuel Macron was forced to postpone a state visit to Germany. Macron had to navigate between condemning the shooting and avoiding antagonizing the powerful police unions, which of course see the violence as ethnic terrorism. France's right wing clamored for Macron to declare a state of emergency. He didn't, but neither did he promise to deal with racial bias among the police, which the UN High Commission on Human Rights condemned in a forceful statement. Meantime, those arrested faced quick trials and harsh sentences if they committed or advocated violence. But the government remains in denial that there's a systemic problem. Swedish membership in NATO. The welcome mat is out for Sweden to join NATO, and the U.S. and 28 other NATO members are four square behind the idea. But Turkey, and to a lesser extent Hungary, are so far against it, and membership requires the approval of the legislatures of all 31 countries. Until a few days ago,